Welcome. I am Andrea Gold, and I am your host for tonight's NAIA-BPD GAP Series call-in, and it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Francesca Paraplechikova. Her work reflects a unique and important contribution to this year's theme of our series, Youth Prevention and Early Intervention of Borderline Personality Disorder. Specifically, Francesca has developed a pediatric application of dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, for kids. As many of our callers know, DBT is one of the main evidence-based psychotherapies for adults with BPD, and Francesca's treatment, which is called DBT-C, adapts DBT to pre-adolescent children with severe emotional and behavioral dysregulation. Now, Francesca is somebody who's uniquely well-suited to do this huge undertaking. Francesca completed her PhD in clinical psychology at Yale University, where her doctoral research focused on treatment integrity. She has expertise in parent management training, and she also completed her clinical internship and postdoctoral training at the Yale School of Medicine in DBT. This integration of her training and expertise in treatment research, parent training, adolescent and child psychotherapy, and DBT is evident in her skillful development of DBT-C, the manual itself, and also her rigorous clinical science testing the effectiveness of this treatment. Francesca has some exciting data from a couple of randomized controlled trials of her treatment, including a recent publication, and she'll be sharing her results on the call today. And she received an NIMH grant to develop DBTC. She is currently an assistant professor of psychology in psychiatry and the founding director of the Youth DBT program at the Weill Cornell Medical School and New York Presbyterian Hospital. So we'll start out with a presentation from Francesca, followed by a discussion of your questions. And please do remember to email them in to us. Welcome, Francesca.
Well, thank you so much, Andrea, for such a wonderful introduction. Hi, everybody. It's my pleasure and privilege to be here tonight with you. And thank you so much for dialing in on Sunday night. And it shows that you have a lot of interest in what I have to present. And I'm deeply grateful for that interest. Now, as Andrea said, my interest is in psychotherapy development research, and I'm particularly interested in looking how to help children who are emotionally dysregulated and, of course, have concomitant behavioral issues stemming from their severe emotional dysregulation. When we talk about emotional dysregulation, if you can imagine a continuum where on one end we have callous and emotional, on the other hand we have emotionally sensitive, DBT is mostly has been looking at how to help people who are closer to the emotional sensitive pole. However, there is some research that I have conducted recently that shows that it can be applicable to the broader range of issues. However, what we're going to be talking today about is a primary application of DBT. I'm hoping that you'll be able to follow me along looking at the slides, and I'll be telling you which slide I'm currently on. So if you go to slide number 3, you will see the definition of emotional sensitivity. So the target population of DBT for children is 7 to 12-year-olds who are presenting with high emotional sensitivity, pronounced as high reactivity. They are, a lot of the time, are reacting to cues that may actually be completely unnoticeable to the external environment. It could be somebody looking at them, somebody not saying things or saying things. It could be internal experiences such as thoughts, memories, associations, and they can react to these cues, to these stressors, out of proportion to the situation, meaning that it's not commensurate with the stressors. They go from 0 to 100. They go from 0 to 100 in a split second, and it takes them a long time to calm down. When I talk with these children about the experiences, a lot of the time they're describing it as extreme emotional waves, like tsunamis, are overcoming them, and they're saying that they're losing control and they're not able to deal with the intensity of the emotions that on a level that will be actually helpful for them to either not get stuck in the emotional experience or to prevent it from happening. And as you can imagine, when you have such high emotional sensitivity and reactivity, there are a lot of corresponding behavioral issues. These children, a lot of the time, have verbal, physical aggression, a lot of talking back behaviors. They may have a lot of destructive behaviors. And when you go to the slide, next slide number 4, a lot of the time, emotional sensitivity comes in a package. Most of these children will have most of the issues that I'm describing on that slide in the list of what their presenting problems are. Now, the first thing that you'll see there is they look for ways to avoid effort. And in parentheses, you'll see double gravity. What do I mean by that? If you can imagine walking on the face of this earth with your own body weight on your shoulders, are you going to look for ways to run, or are you going to look for ways to just lay down somewhere? Now, these children are indeed walking in double gravity because they not only have to overcome the challenge of the impact of the stressor, they also have to overcome the challenge of the extreme emotional reaction to that stressor. So they're not looking for opportunities for more challenges, and therefore they're looking for ways to avoid effort. But that's not because they're lazy necessarily, because that's one of the things that parents are coming to me and saying, my child is lazy. And when I explain the double gravity effect, parents usually say, aha, that's what that could be. And now we're turning parents into looking at their child from a different perspective. Now we're turning the parents' attention to what makes sense in the child's behavior. Now we talk about validation, and validation is a big part of the treatment, and as you will learn more about it. And a lot of the things that we do in DBT is we are providing psychoeducation to parents about their child's condition so that they indeed will turn from criticism, judgment, and invalidation to understanding the child and actually communicating that understanding to the child. Now, these children are also notorious for having trouble with transitions and change. Even transitions to experiences that they have had before and found pleasurable and interesting. And parents sometimes are kind of perplexed. You know, you've been to that event before. You've been there and you had a lot of fun last week. How come today you don't want to go? Now, this is not about that event not being pleasurable last week. It's about transitioning from what's safe and familiar right now to something that may actually be not familiar necessarily in a couple of minutes, something new. Now, when you have an intense emotional reaction, this is something that they're trying to avoid. Now, these children are also easily bored, and they have pretty much almost no tolerance for delayed gratification. They want what they want now, and they experience tremendous pain not getting it. And as you can see, a lot of temper tantrums can indeed be coming from that inability to delay gratification. They also have rapidly shifting attention. A lot of them are hyperactive. They display impulsive behaviors. Now, they also may have sensory sensitivity to auditory stimulus, smell, taste, touch. In my sample of children with emotional sensitivity, in my own research, 70% of these children indeed had some problems, and 25% had definite problems, clinical level problems with sensory sensitivity. And interestingly enough, if they did not have it themselves, their sibling would or their parent would. So it almost seems that there's this wiring in the brain in which there's a sensitivity to the emotion and to the sensory. They're also hyperreactive. There's a lot of anxieties. They have temper outbursts. Unfortunately, listen, we're talking about 7-year-olds, and the mean age of my sample was 10, and already these children are presenting with non-suicidal self-injury and indeed also with suicidal ideation. They also have severe interpersonal difficulties. They vacillate between intense moments of trying to attach and intense moments of rage with parents, with siblings, with peers. They have extreme thinking styles. If you can think about it, when we have high emotional arousal, our cognition constricts. We cannot think straight necessarily, So there's a lot of black and white thinking, catastrophizing. Also, for some reason, they also have difficulty with personal hygiene. All of them have difficulty with brushing teeth and taking baths. You know, it can also be understood because it's boring and it's effort and they don't necessarily want to extend it. Now, that was about the challenges that emotional sensitivity presents. Now, if you think about the dialectic, everything has two sides, including emotional sensitivity. And this is something that I spend a lot of time explaining to the parents, that yes, challenges are very pronounced. That's why you're here. That's why you're in treatment. But think about the other side of it. And research shows that emotional sensitivity also presents with advantages, such as these children are able to experience positive emotions to a higher level. And sometimes that goes right into the challenges because they may get so excited that they become silly and disruptive. Now, they're also able to read other people's emotions on a different level. Those of you who work with clients with borderline personality disorders with adults, you probably know that these clients can read you like a page. They know what you're thinking. They know it. And these children are even more adept to doing that because they still are not entrenched in their ways, and they sometimes can trust themselves and their intuition more than adult clients who've been notoriously told, pervasively told, that what they're thinking, doing, and feeling are all incorrect, and therefore they stopped trusting themselves. Unfortunately, these children are not there, so they indeed can be much better at reading other people's emotions. They also have enhanced empathy. They understand better what pain means, and they're usually the first ones who run there and say, are you okay? Can I help you? What's happening to you? Research also shows that these children have increased creativity. Now, the message with that is when you present the dialectic of this, the two sides, you are indeed helping the child and the parents to understand emotional sensitivity per se is not necessarily a problem to correct. This is something that's too strong for the child to withstand, the impact of the emotional arousal. So what we need to do, we need to give the child skills, we need to give the child training to develop the emotion regulation muscles. So pretty much training the child to be this emotion, you know, regulation bodybuilder so that they can withstand the challenge of the tsunamis that are overcoming them. Unfortunately, emotional sensitivity have a negative connotation. On slide number 6, you will see that we went from saying emotionally sensitive to talking about a term supersensor. When you say supersensor instead of emotionally sensitive, that actually decreases risk of pathologizing because sensitivity, unfortunately, gained this connotation of being paranoid, being a drama queen, being neurotic. So it also avoids the risk of invalidation. Of course, it provides dialectical view of the presenting issues. And indeed, it gives children and parents a sense of relief and even contentment because they understand, oh, there's advantages to what I have. And if you can imagine, when you tell the child, listen, you have your super sensor, and we're going to give you super skills to be able to control your super abilities better. So now we are increasing child's willingness and interest to actually learn techniques. When on slide number 7, what you have is the current research indicating that when these children grow up, if this is not something that is being treated as early as possible, the disruptive mood and corresponding to behavioral dysregulation over time morph. What are they morphing into? They're no longer on the floor kicking and screaming and have a temper tantrum when they're 21, when they're young adults or older adolescents. What they do, unfortunately, is they may pick up things such as alcohol use, drug use, suicidality, non-suicidal self-injury. They have clinical level anxiety disorders, depression. They may have personality disorders. When you think about why there's so much issues that I can actually, you know, morph into from this emotional dysregulation, because over time they are trying to figure out a way to help themselves to cope with emotional sensitivity and this overreactivity because it's very painful to be with it. And the most effective short-term way of coping with the pain and misery it causes is what? Self-harm, suicidality, drug use, alcohol use. Now, this is our primary goal. Our primary goal when we start talking about what is our treatment target hierarchy, please remember this slide, because our primary goal in whatever we're doing is going to be decreased risk of psychopathology in the future. Whatever we're going to be doing, even if it backfires in the present, for example, when you start using a technique of ignoring, as soon as you start ignoring, what's going to happen? You're going to have an extinction burst. You're going to have a behavioral escalation from a child saying, hey, a behavior that used to be reinforced by attention, even negative attention, such as being screamed at, that behavior all of a sudden is not reinforced because the parents are ignoring. So you're going to have more of that behavior in the short term. And if you continue to hold on to your guns and not to provide attention, that behavior is going to subside and actually diminish and may go away in the future. So this is a very straightforward example of what I mean when I say whatever we're doing short term may actually backfire, but as soon as it gives us long term changes, that's what we need to keep in mind. How does emotional sensitivity translate into emotional dysregulation? On slide number 8, you'll see this transaction between the emotional sensitivity and invalidating environment. What is a transaction? Transaction is two variables actually transacting with each other, in which children who are coming into this world with needs that may be above and beyond what environment is capable of dealing, because environment may not even understand why the child is so reactive. I do have a lot of families coming in. They have multiple children. Two are fine, and this one is pretty much, is screaming and yelling in the drop of their hair. So what is happening with him? Environment may not understand it, and environment may not be able to help the child effectively with it. So the child is overwhelming the environment with the needs. Environment pushes back, invalidates the child in the process by actually communicating that, listen, what you're doing doesn't make sense. What you're feeling doesn't make sense. Why are you so angry? You're not supposed to be so angry right now. Why can't you be like your brother? Why can't you just snap out of it? So a lot of invalidation and dysregulates the child further. More dysregulated child pushes on the environment, dysregulates the environment, overwhelms the environment even further. And here we have back and forth between two variables. Now, when we talk about invalidating environment on slide 9, this is not physically or emotionally abusive parenting. Listen, most of the parents who are coming in are actually good enough, very capable parents who may have other children who are absolutely fine, and they have fine parenting and fine outcomes. It's just this one who is out of control, and they cannot understand why. So invalidating environment can actually be a outcome of this transaction between the child's needs and parental inability to meet these needs, and then you're turning into invalidating, critical, judgmental, and even retaliatory, and that it becomes pervasive. Basically, pervasively telling the child that whatever they're doing, thinking, and feeling does not make sense, is not invalid. So dismissive of the behavior independent of its actual validity. An example of that could be a child's coming home, she's very upset because her friend broke her toy, and now she was kind of very angry and sad and punched her friend. Now the mother is saying, ha, well, you know what, punching your friend because she broke your toy probably is not the most helpful thing to do. Now this is indeed invalidating the invalid. Yes, it is not indeed the most effective way of dealing with a problem. And then mother follows with, and there's nothing to cry about, there's nothing to be angry about. Now the mother is invalidating the valid. She's invalidating an emotion that is actually very understandable and suitable in a situation when your toy is broken by a friend. So you see this pervasive and it's dismissive of both valid and invalid. Now, on slide number 10, what you have is what we actually try to help the parent to become through this treatment. Super sensors may not benefit that well from good enough parenting. Super sensors need super parents. When I describe super parents to parents, I say super parents are like firefighters. Firefighters don't start fires themselves. In parenting terms, that means they don't model verbal and physical aggression. They don't scream at their children. They don't retaliate against their children. they avoid invalidation. They don't pick on their children. They don't provoke their children. On the other hand, so the parents are not afraid of the fires, meaning they're not afraid of their children, they're not afraid of temper outbursts, and which indeed a lot of the time can shape, you know, the environment, the child's reaction can shape the parent into accommodating the child. And then we have a child who indeed is tiptoed around and not asked to do anything that can be provoking to the child, which indeed not teaching the child anything about how to control issues and how to indeed cope with their emotional reactivity, and indeed has causes a lot of problems. So firefighters, just the parents like firefighters, they don't start fires. They're not afraid of fires. They're not afraid of the outbursts. What they do is they calmly and skillfully work on putting the fires down, and they work on preventing fires. So that includes validating the child, holding and containing the child's anger, rage, anxiety. We'll talk more about what that means. Prompting, reinforcing adaptive behaviors, using effective parenting techniques, doing daily reinforced skills practices with the child. So these are all of the things that we are helping the parents to do and learn how to do effectively as they're being very mindful of their own proclivities to start the fires and their own proclivities to accommodate the child. On slide 11, you'll see that the standard DBT target treatment target hierarchy consists of four main targets. Now, DBT for children is much more extended in the treatment target hierarchies because we have something that DBT for adults does not have. We have an ability to change the environment in the current. Most of the time, DBT for adults is working with the end result of what has happened to the child and young adolescent. Now, in DBT for children, we can actually make this environment become validating and change ready. So that means that we need to incorporate a lot of targets into the into our hierarchy that's going to address that need. So standard DBT is the treatment target hierarchy consists of what? Reduced life-threatening behaviors, suicidality, non-suicidal injury. Then reduced treatment-interfering behaviors, not coming in, not following through plans, rescheduling, dropping out of treatment. Then reduced quality of life-interfering behaviors. That could be unemployment, relationship problems, comorbid disorders, and only then skills training. Now, DBT for children is expanded to 10 treatment target hierarchies. That is on slide number 12. Three main goals, the one we already discussed, decrease risk of psychopathology in the future. We already talked about it. The next big one, overarching one, is parent-child relationship. There's not much we can do with the child in the home environment if the child is avoiding the parent, if the parent is retaliatory and the child does not want to spend time with them, because what we need to do is we need to get the parent to become the therapist for the child and to be able to do mindfulness practices, to be able to prompt the behaviors, to be able to model the adaptive coping, to be able to reinforce the behavior. None of that is going to happen if the child is avoiding the parent and the relationship is so strained that the child's main function of temper outbursts is to actually cause misery to a parent because they're making them miserable, and the child in no way wants to make the parent happy or please the parent. And whatever skills I'm going to teach, whatever reinforcement programs we're going to put in, none of that is going to be helpful because the function is to cause misery and not necessarily to please the parent. So we need to work on getting the relationship and healing the relationship enough for all of that to happen. And only third one is addressing the current child's symptoms. That's what parents are here for. And you see, this is number 7. And if we go very briefly through the targets, you will see that most of the primary targets up higher on our treatment target hierarchy is parent, parent, parent. Of course, number one is life-threatening. We need to keep the child life, healthy, and there to be able to help the child. therapy destroying behaviors are the ones that precluding our ability to implement techniques. Unfortunately, I cannot go into the details of that. But then we'll see what's happening. Therapy interfering behaviors of the parents. If parents aren't coming in, parents are not following through with plans, parents are rescheduling, we cannot do much. Parental emotion regulation, effective parenting skills, improving parent-child relationship, and only after that, we're going to talk about unsafe, risky behaviors such as physical aggression, quality of life interfering behaviors, verbal aggression, skills training, and the last one is therapy interfering behavior of a child. Now, if child is coming in screaming, yelling, devaluing treatment, not engaging in therapy, playing video games during treatment, you know, all of this is indeed therapy interfering behaviors. However, they are also target relevant and very informative, meaning that I can actually see the dynamic in action. I can see what the child is doing. So this is very informative to me and to therapists to figure out what is it that we actually need to address instead of just being told. Now, it's also very target relevant because indeed, in this moment, I can help parents manage child's behavior. I can show them what to do. I can help them to with their own emotion regulation in the moment. I can help them with ignoring. And I can also do what? I can also help with extinction of the behavior because now I'm extinguishing this behavior at home and during treatment. Now let's look at the next slide, number 13. My goal is not necessarily to keep the child in treatment for years. Absolutely not. And when we talk about emotional dysregulation, emotional sensitivity, this is not something that is correctable within, 12, 15 sessions. This takes time. But I don't necessarily need to have the child in treatment with me forever. But what I need to do is I need to train the parent to be the therapist for the child. Children may not be necessarily there cognitively and developmentally to appreciate all of the skills that I have to teach and all of the concepts that in psychoeducation that I have to offer. But parents can. And parents can continue to communicate all of that. And parents can continue to teach all of this to children and model all of these behaviors long after I'm no longer seeing the parents. So DBT for children, if you see slide number 21, is based on three main mechanisms of change. The very first one is parental emotion regulation. The next one is validating environment. And the third one is daily skills practice. You see, the word is practice, not use. I'll tell you what I mean by this in a moment. Now, parental emotion regulation, slide 15. If parents are not emotion regulated themselves, there's not much I can do in helping the child because we cannot have a regulated child in dysregulated environment. We cannot have the child not scream, yell, punch if that's exactly what parents are doing to the child. And parents, if they're not emotion regulated, cannot model the skills use, cannot reinforce adaptive behaviors, cannot ignore dysfunctional behaviors effectively, cannot suppress dangerous behaviors, cannot validate child's distress. None of that is happening because usually when you need to do that, something is happening that's quite emotionally dysregulated. Therefore, I actually start teaching parents emotion regulation skills at the level of assessment as soon as possible. If when I'm assessing the child's condition, I'm also assessing parental readiness to actually engage in this treatment. And I'm continuing to communicate to the parents, yes, your child is in treatment and he is our target. However, you guys are going to be in a spotlight. I'll be asking much more of you. And the model now is shaped to be in the way of, I actually most of the time see parents by themselves and rarely see child regularly unless there's a suicidality and self-harm. But even with that, I stabilize the child and then I continue to focus on the parents for the first month or so, parents, teaching them everything they need to know, teaching them to get the skills down in their tool belt, so to speak, so that they can indeed can regulate and they can be ready for what's to come when child comes to treatment. And we're going to do what? therapy is indeed disrupting a dynamic that is already established. Nobody's probably happy with that dynamic because everybody's as miserable, otherwise therapy will not be needed. However, this is something that's familiar. This is something that everybody knows what's going to happen. Therapy disrupts that, and child usually does not really happy with all of the changes that are to come, and the different ways and different techniques, new ways of parents relating to the child, and that indeed can temporarily cause more problems. So indeed, it does get worse before it gets ready, and parents need to be ready for it, and I need to have regulated, knowledgeable parents to withstand the impact, because otherwise we can actually make it worse. If you can imagine parents never ignoring child's outbursts, for example, and now they're ignoring it for 20 minutes. Great, much better. But then at minute 21, they're no longer able to withstand the impact, and they break down and they start screaming, going back to the usual. So what we just did, we made the situation worse, because in the future, the child is not going to start where they usually are. They're going to start at a more dysregulated moment. They're going to start at the behavioral escalation level. So to avoid all of that, we indeed need to make sure that parents understand their role, understand what they need to do, and are prepared to do that. So slide number I don't have a number on it, but there would be slide number 16, is giving you a parent training component. So everything that children learn, parents learn. Skills, didactics and emotions, plus on top of that, they need to learn how to create a validating environment. They need to become behaviorists, in a sense. They need to know what are those behavioral modification techniques that are effective. They also need to understand the dialectic of parenting and how to walk the middle path. So all of that is within the parent training curriculum. And on top of that, of course, there are also presents for skills training that we do with children. If you get to the next slide, the functions of positive parent-child relationship. Remember, this is our this is within our three main goals. This is goal number two. And as I already mentioned, this is extremely important because positive parent-child relationship models positive interaction that's built on trust, reinforcement, shared interest, mutual respect, and that helps instill in the child three most important things that parents need to promote in their child: sense of self-love, safety, and belonging. Unfortunately, I cannot go deep into all of that, but this is one of the things that we teach parents as a critical moment in their parenting, because a lot of people can provide shelter and sustenance to the child. But when you talk about parenting, these three things that parenting needs to have, that actually defines whether or not you're doing parenting effectively, or the child may indeed have problems in the future, because it's very hard when you grow up without developed sense of love, self-love, safety, and belonging to reparent yourself and achieve those thresholds to be able to actually have these three senses. Now, the other thing about the positive parent-child relationship, it indeed, as we said, increases the child's desire to spend time with parents, which provides parents with opportunities to model adaptive parenting and coping, prompt effective responding, and provide validation and reinforcement. It, of course, also increases child's motivation to behave in ways that's going to please parents, make them proud, and earn rewards. And this is a developing brain. So we're actually building pathways in the child's developing brain associated with adaptive behaviors as opposed to maladaptive behaviors. So to speak, rewriting the code. In the next slide, some of the things that interfere with effective parenting. Now, we spend a lot of time going through each and every one of them. The one that I wanted to briefly touch upon, I cannot touch upon all of them, but what I would briefly want to touch upon is one of the pervasive things that's happening with parenting. Most of us are attached to outcomes. We paint a very specific picture in our brain of how things are going to happen. And that puts us in a position of being disappointed, because a lot of the time reality does not match our pictures. And then also we have a lot of shoots about how things are going to be. Parents coming in with a lot of shoots of what the child should and should not be doing, and shoots, unfortunately, put parents in a position of no control. What do I mean by that? When you have an idea of how things should happen, there's nothing that you need to do to make that happen. If my child should be saying, thank you, if my child should be polite, if my child should be following directions right away, there's nothing that I need to do to actually promote those behaviors. And a lot of the time, parents do have issues with reinforcement because they're telling me, oh, I don't want to bribe my child, or my child is not a trained SEAL. I'm not going to give him points for doing behaviors that, you know, any normal child would be doing anyway. So here we have shoots. And should put a person in a position of no control, because you're pretty much putting the control in the hands of another person, you know, because they're the ones who are supposed to be doing that, and therefore you're not getting the behaviors that you want. So a lot of these things are being monitored. A lot of these things, there's a lot of psychoeducation about other things such as over-reliance of punishment, over-reliance of shaming, criticism, judgments. Unfortunately, a lot of the time, parenting does consist of what? You know, noticing what the child is doing that parents don't find helpful or adaptive or effective. So when we just highlight that, we are indeed doing what? We're invalidating the child continuously and pervasively. And we're very rarely doing validation, and not as much of a shaping, not as much of a reinforcement programs as we need to, because of over-reliance. And why do we over-rely on that? Because punishment, criticism, and judgment are mood consistent. We want to do those in the moment because we are upset. We, in the moment when we're upset, we don't want to reinforce. We don't want to ignore. We don't want to validate because it's mood inconsistent. And here we go back to having the parents prepared to understand that, prepared to catch that in their own behaviors, and prepared to act opposite to what is mood consistent, and indeed act in what is effective as opposed to what we want to do in the moment. Now, on the next slide, remember our third mechanism of change, skills practice. Skills practice is not necessarily the same as skills use. Skills use is happening when there is already a problematic behavior, problematic situation happening, and there's not necessarily enough time to decide what you need to do. A lot of the time, you need to already rely on overlearned technique, and usually, how often, especially in the beginning, you're indeed going to catch a child use a skill, maybe once, maybe twice a week. Is that enough of reinforced practice for the behavior to be sustained? Absolutely not. Therefore, what we're relying upon is in pretend mode practice. So in real mode is in real situations, you are using skills. In pretend mode is when you're processing the situation, the problematic response of a child after the behavior happened, when the child is already in neutral or positive mood, when you are doing practices in hypothetical problematic situations, let's pretend your sister came into your room and touching all of your stuff, what are you going to do, what kind of skills you're going to use, and then role-playing that and having the child practice the skill and actually reinforcing it with rewards and skills. And points. And the third one is coping ahead of problematic situations that have a high likelihood of occurring. So let's pretend, you know, we're going to this birthday party, there is this kid there that is always giving you trouble. So what are you going to do if indeed he starts to provoke you again? What kind of skill are you going to use? Again, role play it, have the child use the skill, reinforce it. So I require at least two in pretend mode skills practice per day which is actually monitored on a diary card. And if I don't have two reinforced practices per day on a diary card, I treat it as a therapy interfering behavior on the part of the parent, and then we're going to discuss that above and beyond everything else. Because if you think about treatment target hierarchy, it does not mean that we're doing just one thing at a time on this treatment target hierarchy. We can be doing multiple things. However, what we need to be conscious of is what is our priority. When parents coming in to me and they're saying, oh, you know, can you imagine what Johnny did? My first response is, what did you do? How did you react? So you see, I'm going higher on, I'm going to the parental emotion regulation, and I'm going to discuss that above and beyond what the child did. So at every moment, we're keeping the treatment target hierarchy in our mind, and this is something that parents need to learn and understand very well, because they need to keep it in mind at all points and all time that it's about them first and about the child second. And continuing to remember that the mechanisms of change is, number one, their own emotion regulation, number two, their ability to validate, and number three, their ability to practice skills with their child every single day. And what we get out of this is just practicing in pretend mode alone drastically reduces the frequency, duration, and intensity of the behavioral outbursts. And when children come in and I ask them, so what's happening? Why, you know, your diary card looks like, hey, you know, it's just not that many problematic issues anymore. You know what they tell me? Huh, I don't know, things just don't bug me anymore as much. Or they're saying, well, when things do bug me, I just ignore it. I just let go. You know, I just radically accept. So they indeed, through this practice, are able to develop a much higher tolerance to stressors. And here we have exactly what we started with. You know, remember we talked about the bodybuilder of emotion regulation. Every time they are practicing skills in pretend mode, they are indeed developing and building those muscles that help them to withstand the stressors in real life. So main messages to parents during treatment. Child's behavior is irrelevant until the environment is able to effectively support progress. This is very important to remember. Now, they also need to curb their expectations. There is a dialectic on this. We are going to work on promoting change. Remember, we're going to train you to become a super parent, and we need to adopt a stance in which we're promoting change and we're doing our best, and we're not expecting any changes from the child. We're not attached to the outcome. It's not about what the child does. It's about how the parent responds. Now, current behaviors and progress are not as important as long-term progress. Remember, our number one treatment target. Our main tools are validation, reinforced skills practice, and our emotion regulation. We need to hold and contain the child's rage, anxiety, shame, sadness. When the parent is patiently waiting for the child to calm down during ignoring, and attending to the child when they stop screaming just to breathe, this back and forth, the plan-ignoring paradigm, they're holding and containing the child's rage. That's an example of that. And parenting is about promoting the following: sense of self-love, sense of safety, and sense of belonging. So these are the main points that I wanted to communicate to you today. And I know that before we jump into some of the research points about TBT for children, I know Andrea wanted to ask me some questions.
You know what, Francesca, we got a lot of questions. So why don't you briefly summarize your research and then we'll jump into questions.
Absolutely. Okay. So I have finished not too long ago two randomized clinical trials. One of them was on slide 22. This is DBT for children with disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. These are the children who have three or more outbursts per week. They're out of proportion to the actual situation, and they have irritable, angry mood in between outbursts. So what we have done with that, we compared children in DBT to children who have been assigned to treatment as usual, a treatment that was provided in well-known medicine. On slide 24, you will see that there was a big difference in disability outcomes. We had zero dropout rate in DBT for children and 36% dropout rate in TAU. So parents in DBT actually understood the treatment and found it very valuable from the very beginning, and that's what they continued to come in, because this is a very intense intervention. It's 90 minutes per week for 32 weeks. You'll see the results of this in a moment, but what was the cherry on the top for me with the efficacy results was that what you're going to see was without psychiatric medication. So children in DBTC, whoever came into the treatment had psychiatric medication, so they either continued on it or they got titrated out, but not even one additional child was put on psychiatric medications in DBT for children group, but there were three times as many children in treatment as usual on psychiatric meds. So what did we found? We found 90% response rate for DBT for children and 45% response rate in treatment as usual, and we actually improved response rate at follow-up, 3 months follow-up, we had 95% response rate, and the response rate for treatment as usual continued to be at 45%. So I don't have time to go through the results, but you know, you have it on your slides, please read. The other study was DBT for children in residential care. It was also randomized clinical trial, so these children were so severe that they were not capable to maintain at home environment. So I just wanted to, on slide 28, I want to highlight that we did not have a very good attendance by parents. So parents were not indeed trained in DBT for children. And that was actually, unfortunately, for treatment as usual and for DBT. So the next slide, you're going to see that our main outcome for efficacy was child behavior checklist. And you're going to see exactly the same results. Now, we administered child behavior checklist to MILU staff, to teachers, and to parents. Teachers were not trained in DBT because they were working with both populations, with both groups, and parents were not coming in to get trained. But MILU staff did get trained in DBT for children on the same level that parents did in the outpatient study that I have just described on DMDD, and you see the same things. So blue is DBT for children, green is treatment as usual. You'll see pretty much not much change for DBT for treatment as usual, and DBT for children drops below the clinical range, and there is statistically significant difference at each phase of assessment, and this is for total problems. No difference for teachers, no difference for parent report. And that's the same for internalizing behaviors on slide 30, the same for externalizing behaviors on slide 31. So again, this is speaking to me about the importance of the environment. If environment knows what to do, we're going to have changes. If environment is not trained, doesn't know what to do, unfortunately, we cannot do that much. I think I'm done with the research.
Wonderful. Okay, so we've got a lot of questions. Let's jump right in. So one thing I wanted to point out is the last time you talked to our call-in series was 3 years ago, 2014, and your title was very different. And I think this difference shows a lot of progress that you've made. So you had called your talk before DBT for Pre-Adolescent Children, Issues and Challenges in Adaptation and Implementation. So we can see here now you've been able to adapt and implement, and you have a much greater focus on parenting. So could you just give our listeners tonight a bit of background on the issues you faced, lessons you learned, and how you transformed your model to its current form in order to address these challenges?
So I think that most of my talk was just about this question. When I started DBT for children, I started it more within the DBT for adolescent model, where parents were just part of the treatment. They would just come in and they would get trained on skills. But as I was learning more through my interactions with families about how the things are transacting in the environment and the application of the techniques, it became more and more apparent to me that the focus is not on the child. The focus is on the parent, because the child may not be there fully cognitively, developmentally, emotionally, to be able to use these skills themselves without parents fully supporting and modeling and reinforcing the use of the techniques. So because we're not talking about adults here, we're not even talking about adolescents here, child is fully integrated into the system of the family, and the child needs all of that support from the family. When we talk about behavioral change occurs when there are three components. First, you need to be aware of an emotional reaction before you react, before that reaction is translated into action, right? So we go away from I feel it, I do it. Now, you can be aware that you're about to scream, and you can still scream if you're not willing to do something different. Now, you can be aware and willing, but if you don't know what to do instead, you're going to burst into flames at one point and still going to scream. So we have awareness, willingness, and capability. If behavior is not changing, one of these components is missing, or all three of them is missing. Now, awareness. How do we train awareness? This is our mindfulness. Mindfulness means what? Parents and children every day doing mindfulness practices. Child is not going to do it by themselves. Willingness. How do we get to willingness? This is a lot of short-term reinforcement through points, through tangible rewards, through wanting to please the parent and make the parent happy. Again, parent. How do we train capability? Capability is our skills. How do we train it? Reinforce practice every single day. Again, parent. So parents aren't just part of the treatment. They're kind of main tool that we as therapists have to actually help the child.
It's interesting to hear how you changed the model based on your experiences with the kids, and it wasn't what you initially thought.
It was, yeah, so this is all empirical.
Yeah. So that this now relates what you talked about by first having the adolescent kind of approach and then shifting it. It relates to another question we got. What was the setup of groups and treatment? Was it parent only, parent with the kids? Can you speak a little bit more about the structure?
Absolutely. So it's in DBT function over form. Now, if you can imagine a group training with 7 to 13-year-olds with parents on top of it, ain't happening. Most of the material is going to go right over the 7-year-olds, and some of them are developmentally delayed, cognitively delayed. So in outpatient therapy, we do everything on the individual basis. So the sessions are 90 minutes, 30 minutes with the child, 20 with the parents, 40 minutes skills training with child and parent. Now, if you see the residential care trial, now, again, function over form. In that particular environment and setting, we're actually able to do skills training with children, per se, in a group format because they're housed by unit, by age. And they already have the environment in which they can do skills training in their units. So we did skills training twice a week with them, plus individual therapy. And then parents were supposed to have twice per month 2-hour skills training and didactics on emotions. So that's again function over form depending on setting.
Great. And one listener asked if you teach the parents all of the 4 modules taught in standard DBT or just emotion regulation and distress tolerance.
Everything. We teach DBT for children incorporated pretty much everything that DBT for adults has, the new DBT, the 2015 manual. Now, they're only what can be seen as not very developmentally appropriate. There are like 2 or 3 things that was removed from that, but pretty much almost the entire curriculum of DBT for adults is in DBT for children. It's just repackaged and simplified.
So do you, thinking about parents getting the skills, do you have any data or clinical observations about what proportion of parents of these kids themselves are super sensors?
We don't have necessarily that data because we actually figured out a lot of that as we were already in a trial. These trials are pilot trials, and now we have a much more information, and we have a much more empirically based questions that we're going to be able to ask within the next trials.
And that's what about observations? Is something that
clinical observations. I would say that at least one of the parents would be a super sensor themselves.
So would you tend, from your experience, to refer these parents out to DBT or other treatments, or would you say that they're really able to get the meat and potatoes of DBT in the groups that they're doing with their kids?
We treat in-house because we want, number one, we want to make sure that parents learn the same techniques, because DBT for children, the language and the skills looks different from DBT for adults. The concepts, the strategies and procedures are retained without change. The packaging and the wording of the skills is a bit different. So we mm-hmm. don't want multiple different ways in which it's taught. So everything is in the house, and we find that this is sufficient. We don't need to refer parents out to get trained somewhere else in DBT. Everything is happening with their children, and we indeed can sometimes refer parents for other therapy, but that would be maybe couple therapy, mm-hmm, or they mm-hmm. can be for some of the other psychopathology that parent may have. That could be above and beyond what we can offer, because we cannot concentrate that much on the parent themselves. We need to concentrate on the parent within the context of the child's needs.
Makes sense. Okay, I want to shift gears a bit. Going to slide 4, you talk about the package that tends to come along with kids with high emotional sensitivity. So one listener asked, if another behavior that's adopted in childhood that goes along with emotional sensitivity tends to be numbing out, going underground. I think that this person may be asking about dissociation, perhaps.
Dissociation, right. That happens too. Usually that's associated with comorbidity with PTSD. That would be trauma mm-hmm. response most of the time. Yes, but interestingly, not a lot of children in my trials, at least, indeed come in with PTSD or some severe trauma that happened to them. Hmm. Most of them, actually, there's only like 1% or 2% of children in the outpatient trial had PTSD.
Gotcha. And this relates to actually where I was going next, thinking about developmental precursors, if we focus on BPD, there, of course, there's lots of data showing that a majority of people who have BPD in adulthood have had trauma exposure. Mm-hmm. And I'm, kind of thinking about this big question about, this emotional sensitivity being a precursor to BPD later in life. So this package that you see on slide 4, could you tell us about how what you see in kids and also in particular with kids with DMDD, how these features are similar to BPD and any specific ways in which you see this as being different?
Actually, very similar. Very, very similar. I treat adults, I treat adolescents, and I treat children, and these children have have the presentation of borderline personality disorder. I don't usually diagnose readily children as young as that with a personality disorder, because some of the BPD criteria for diagnosis can be consistent with the developmental age, such as unstable self-image, such as difficulty with anger outburst, and there's a third one that I'm blacking out on right now. So we're reducing 9 criteria to 6. Mm-hmm. So now it becomes much harder to diagnose BPD in a child, and it needs to be consistent and persistent for many years. So when we talk about 7 to 12-year-olds, they may not have enough time to actually fit that particular criteria. But outside of, assigning a label to a child, whether they have BPD or disruptive mood dysregulation, they indeed look very similar.
Gotcha.
Because
and that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're drawing distinctions between pre-adolescent and adolescent.
Yes, exactly. Severe interpersonal difficulties, extreme thinking style, non-suicidal self-injury, suicidality, so hyper-reactivity, all of that is within the BPD.
So another question about these parallel. So you talk about the biosocial theory of DMDD, which is adapted from Linehan's biosocial theory of BPD. Are there any differences between the two theories, or is the way that you're using
yes.
the theory
yes.
for DMDD the same?
Yes, there is a difference. So within the biosocial theory for adults, what you see is the presentation of emotional dysregulation, irregularity. There is a pathology assigned to a biology. So, and there is no dialectic in it. When we talk about the BPD biosocial theory, what's missing in it is the dialectic of it's not only challenges, but there are also some adaptive, there's some advantages to it. And when I actually talked to Marcia, and I actually talked to some other people within the even, you know, behavioral tech and training models, after I've developed this package and this model, they indeed are going to probably move away from the original way of presenting it to presenting it dialectically.
You're using this label super sensors with your kids, 7 to 12. Mm-hmm. Do you think that adults with BPD could also receive that kind of label, super sensor, and you might find that helpful too in adulthood?
I would say so. Now, we need to figure out where is it coming from. Because you may have a person who was not a super sensor in a childhood but sustained tremendous traumas.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be careful in just applying the label without figuring out where exactly the psychopathology is stemming from. So
if I understand that correctly, mm-hmm. I just want to make sure I follow. So the emotion vulnerability, the reactivity, and slow return to baseline, you're saying could be a consequence of a trauma and PTSD rather than a pre-existing vulnerability that a kid's born with?
Well, what I'm saying is within the invalidation, there is a harmful invalidation. This is the invalidation that I have discussed today, but there is also a traumatic invalidation.
Mm-hmm,
traumatic
mm-hmm.
invalidation is invalidation on the level of physical, emotional, sexual abuse. So you may have a low level of emotional sensitivity, but that may not necessarily be on the level of a supersensor, but combined with traumatic invalidation, that can give you the outcome that you may see with high emotional sensitivity and harmful invalidation.
Got it. This is really, really interesting stuff to flesh out. Thanks for talking about it. We're over time. I want to get to two quick questions. One is...
I would say that most of people with borderline personality disorder probably have had, you know, this super sensory type of presentation of wiring when they were children, and they continue to have it. Yes, most of them. Yes.
Great. Quick question. So you've done work in parent management training, and a lot of what you're talking about in DBT for kids involves parent training. If you were to mm-hmm. draw a Venn diagram of parent management training in DBT, what would those circles look like? Would PMT, would that be subsumed within DBT for kids, or would there be parts that don't overlap?
Well, PMT is behavioral modification. So it's just mm-hmm. it's just a label, a specific label of something that is much more general. This is behavioral. This is what we know that works to change behaviors. So the Venn diagram would be behavioral modification, validation, right? The two big circles.
Mm-hmm.
And then the middle where they meet would be a change-ready environment, creation of a change-ready environment. So when we combine both, that's exactly what we want the parent to be. The parent's ability to actually bring in onto the page in everyday interaction with the child, ability to validate the child's distress, and non-judgmentally, non-critically help the child to change what's not adaptive.
Wonderful. I could go on all night with more questions, but I'm going to end with the question that I'm sure we received from listeners, and I'm sure most people are wondering this. So the question we actually got had to do with, is there a manual? We know that there is not one published, but I'm wondering if you could tell us what are the conditions and factors that you want to accomplish before you publish the manual, and what does that kind of timeline look like?
I have a contract with Guilford Press to publish the manual into the book, so it's going to be two manuals kind of going alongside with what Marcia published. One is the manual for therapists, and another one is handouts, right? So handouts corresponding to the manual. And the timeline is hopefully 2019. I know it's a long time from now. And I have a lot of emails, people asking me to share materials. And the thing is that sharing materials is not very helpful without training on the materials. This is not a straightforward DBT for adults or even adolescent model. It has much more bells and whistles and much more complicated. Now, in the meantime, what is starting to be offered is through behavioral tech, we are going to start offering trainings. Next training is going to be in April in New York, in which people who are attending the training will be receiving necessary materials to start implementing it. So this is starting next year.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Francesca.
One caveat to training in DBT for children. At this point, I'm offering training to people who train in DBT for adults, in foundational or intensive, because I'm not training in DBT. I'm training in DBT for kids.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have a foundation to understand what I'm talking about.
Great. Well, we are over, so we should end, but thank you so much. This was fabulous.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Francesca. Thank you, Perry.
Oh, I just want to remind our listeners we're off for the next couple weeks. Please join us for our next call on January 7th with Dr. Carla Chugani, who will talk about DBT adaptations for an older population. This is for college students. And to everyone, so please consider making a donation to NEABPD. You can do this on our website, and this will help support efforts such as this series. We would greatly appreciate it. Thanks, and good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thanks.